what they're doing. They are incredibly skillful at assessing your weaknesses and taking advantage of them. Where the confusion begins is that in a vampire-empath relationship, the vampire is initially very supportive of your goals and dreams. Because the vampire is so often adroit at initially supporting you in your efforts to heal, you begin to trust them and their judgment. You feel as though you've finally found someone who gets you, wounds and all. You relax and let your guard down, and perhaps you let them into your life deeper than you've allowed anyone else. Their hooks are now in you. This is when they begin to criticize you and use their inner knowledge of you to discredit the people, things, and dreams that are your passions, all of which they initially supported. At one point in my career, I had a colleague who was incredibly supportive and helpful with my work. This was extraordinarily rare at the time because, as a holistic physician, I was always waiting for the next shoe to drop and for the authorities to punish me in some way for my beliefs and approach to healing. Over time, however, this individual used her intuition to tell me what was wrong with just about everyone who came into my life, personally or professionally. I initially found this very confusing, as she had been a gifted intuitive whose guidance had been very helpful. But after a while, I came to realize that if I didn't cut off the friendship completely, I would eventually end up walled off from the world entirely, and the only person who would be interpreting my reality for me would be her. She even tried to come between my daughters and me. But I saw the pattern. It was exactly how abusive men isolate their victims. This often happens so slowly and under the guise of caring for you, that you don't realize what is going on when it's happening. Vampires in your life. So take a look at your own life. How many of your friends, or worse yet, family members, call you only when they want something or have a problem? Notice how these same people never call you just to check in on how you're doing. It's a one-way street, with all the attention and energy going to them, not you. Take notice of who calls you for advice, to complain, or to simply talk on and on while you listen. This is a pattern that went on for decades with me until it finally dawned on me that these individuals never called unless they wanted something. Here's an example. I'd get a call from an old friend and think, oh, how nice. They're reaching out because they care and want to acknowledge me. My little inner child would get excited. Oh, goody, they're checking in. They really care about me. And then the other shoe would invariably drop when I quickly realized that the only reason they called was so I'd give a quote for their manuscript, make an introduction for them, or give them some healing advice about a health problem they or an acquaintance was having. The thin veneer of caring about me went away very quickly, with nothing given in return. Before we empaths realize what is happening and stop the behavior, we often find ourselves freely sharing our wisdom, time, and resources with those who call us during nights, weekends, and just about any time it's convenient for them. We give freely because that's our nature, and we fan the flames of their potential lovingly. And when they hang up the phone, we, at first, maybe for years, feel good about ourselves for being valuable to them, but over time, we find that they are not there for us, and very often, they don't even follow our advice, and nothing changes. They just wanted a hit of our energy, or a voice on the other end of the phone telling them what they already know, or else they want us to do something for them. Those who call and never change very often have a lot of drama in their lives. They feed off it and create it. That's why, at first glance, they're so exciting to be around. Have you noticed that? I was recently visiting an old friend, and we were talking about the friend who first introduced us decades ago. I'll call her Joan. As we shared our stories about Joan, we both realized that each of us had spent hours and hours over the years listening to her dramas, trying to help her solve her problems. But she never changed. She simply went from drama to drama, while we tried to help her out financially and socially. Finally, we both saw the pattern and withdrew. Comparing notes was eye-opening. You too? Yep, me too. Here's the thing. If there were no drama, the energy vampires would have to look at the spiritual side of life, but they're afraid of it. Trauma and drama are comfortable. This is why the mainstream news cycle is so negative. It's familiar and comfortable, and it sells product. It is also addictive. There's always something to fix, something outside yourself to focus on, so that you never have to look inside. The only place where your true power lies. The place where no one else can do the work for you. When there's nothing more to fix, the only thing you have left is the divine, by whatever name you choose to call it. And vampires don't want to go there because their approach to life works for them. They genuinely don't think anything is wrong with them. Why would they need to look inside? The goodies are all outside. Money, sex, power. In a subsection of his classic book, Without Conscience, The Disturbing World of the Psychopaths Among Us, Dr. Robert D. Hare, an expert in this field, writes about why nothing seems to work with the worst of these characters. And here is the crux of the issue. Psychopaths don't feel they have psychological or emotional problems, and they see no reason to change their behavior to conform to societal standards, with which they do not agree. Empaths, on the other hand, generally have a very solid relationship with God and their faith in a divine source. We feel bad for those who don't, and we're eager to share that deep and abiding faith with another. But they don't want to do the work of contacting that divine within. They'd rather just get a hit of our energy to keep them afloat until the next time. And if we don't recognize our own role in keeping this drama going, which is attempting to be their higher power by being available all the time and having all the answers, then we risk losing ourselves and enabling them to stay stuck. Do you see this happening in any of your relationships? Stuck in relationship. If you're in a relationship with an energy vampire, the question is, why don't you get out? Why don't you speak up and protect yourself? As I mentioned, many empaths do get out. They see the problems and ditch the vampire pronto. But for those who don't, there are two main reasons. First, you are naturally compassionate and caring, so you may simply miss the red flags. That can happen if you're not fully paying attention to your intuition and the circumstances around you. And second, your wounds have created in you a powerful desire to be accepted and an overwhelming belief that you shouldn't hurt other people's feelings. And for old soul empaths, there's a third thing that keeps us stuck. We truly believe that our love and caring can heal other people, in this case, the vampire. And though we may see the red flags, we believe that things will be different with us, that those other people who hurt the vampire just didn't have the skill and compassion that we have. While our initial response to their inevitable ill treatment of us is anger, hurt, and disappointment, we quickly squelch these natural feelings and replace them with guilt, something we learned to do in the past, either way far back in another lifetime or in childhood, or more likely, both. We make the mistake of thinking that energy vampires are as sensitive as we are. We don't want to risk hurting their feelings. So in order to protect them and their feelings, and because we're so darn good at solving problems in all the other areas of our lives, we keep giving them our energy and draining ourselves, rather than risk standing up to them, standing up for ourselves, and owning how angry, hurt, and disappointed we really feel, and then ending the relationship. We take on the responsibility of trying to convince them to get help and to change their ways. But this is a dead-end street because they don't change. What has to change in every single relationship with an energy vampire is you. You need to finally be done and get out of the relationship. I know this is hard to hear, especially for those of you who have invested so many years and resources into making the relationship work. But the sooner you give up on them and choose you, the healthier, happier, and more effective you will become. One of my friends, who has recently been recovering from a marriage to an energy vampire, was telling me about how her life has changed since she finally left him. As part of her healing, she recalled a past life in which she was old and in a cave. Her entire tribe was abandoning her, and almost every member of the tribe had been a child that she, as a midwife, had brought into this world. Talk about abandonment and grief. In her current lifetime, her family called her weird from the time she was a little girl for her interest in meditation, yoga, Sanskrit, nutrition, and healing dance. Her skills in those areas are off the charts. However, her self-trust and self-esteem were always on the low end of the spectrum given her background. Plus, she has a lot of self-sacrificing energy and shame as a result of taking vows of poverty and chastity in many monastic past lives that involved self-flagellation and brainwashing about her worthiness as a woman. This is what had made her a sitting duck for an energy vampire despite her super traits and multiple PhDs. She had come into this life believing that she was unlovable, so when she met this handsome and charming man who started the relationship love-bombing her and paying a great deal of attention to her, she was all in. When they met, he had just had a windfall of money from the sale of a family business, a business he didn't build. It was just inherited money. And then, after they were married, he immediately came down with one excuse after another about why his business ventures always fell through. He was, as they say in Texas, all hat and no cattle. Because she didn't know about the deadly dance between old soul empaths and energy vampires, she did everything in her power to uplift him and make him successful. She paid for him to go through a bunch of business trainings and also paid for many of his recreational trips, all the while hoping this would make him happy and successful. After all, he was tall and handsome and had so much potential. While she worked 80-plus hours per week at 3 different jobs, he contributed almost nothing. And yet, he accused her of overspending. After 19 years of this, she found herself suffering from adrenal fatigue, insomnia, thyroid problems, sore breasts, and very low self-esteem. She also began to doubt her own sanity. The lack of self-worth and need to be accepted and loved that many have makes us a perfect target for energy vampires and the darker parts of human nature. This is true not just in our most intimate relationships, but also in work settings. One woman I worked with had a job as a personal secretary for a very wealthy and successful man. Though she was well-educated and did her job beautifully, he continually asked for more. And then she'd say, "These additional hours are not in our agreement," and he'd reply, "But sweetheart, you run my entire life. What would I do without you?" And that would appeal to her conscientiousness. Oh, wow, he really needs me. I'm making a difference. She couldn't manage to create a boundary between her private life and work because he always violated them. One of her co-workers, who had watched this play out with her predecessors, once said to her, "If you're still here by December, I'll know you're crazy." When she finally left because of failing health, her boss's final words were not, "Thank you so much for doing an amazing job." Nope, they were, "Will you miss me?" We also see this dynamic a lot in spiritual relationships. As mentioned before, old soul empaths are drawn to spiritual teachings and gatherings, and many have been drawn to various gurus. I actually experienced this myself when I became involved with a meditation movement that was just getting started. The organization tried very hard to enroll me as a teacher. I even set up a bunch of lectures in my hometown. But I soon saw that this organization, and others like it, expected a huge amount of unpaid service. The only person who ended up with any resources at all was the guru. I'm not talking about individuals who have enjoyed a fruitful experience with a spiritual organization that has uplifted them and made their lives better. This is certainly possible. But I've seen far too many gurus of all stripes, some religious, some not, who dupe unwitting empaths into supporting causes that end up draining the devotee of her self-esteem, money, and time. This happens over and over again with charismatic leaders who pretend that they have a direct line to God, when in truth, God is not outside of us in some prophet form. God is inside. That's what we've come to live and teach by example. The vampire, whether a man, a woman, a lover, a co-worker, or a guru, survives by draining the life force and resources of the empath, who too often ends up sick, confused, broke, and emotionally devastated. All because the wounds of the empath were used against them, and they didn't know it until it was too late. Sucking your life's blood. To understand what I mean by survives by draining the life force, we need to look at the term narcissistic supply. This is a game changer once you understand the dynamics in a vampire relationship. Narcissistic supply is the blood that manipulative people suck out of empaths. Vampires manipulate others for this narcissistic supply, which comes in the form of attention, money, sex, and status. There's an old saying, talk about me good, talk about me bad, just talk about me. Vampires tend to suck all the oxygen out of whatever room they are in, because there's some kind of abyss inside that can't be filled. But that doesn't stop them from trying. Vampires will often pick a fight if things are going too smoothly, just to get a hit of energy. It doesn't matter if the energy is good or bad. That's what narcissistic supply is, directing energy, attention, and money toward themselves, which they do very skillfully. Sometimes the energy drain in the direction of the vampire is so striking that you literally feel like falling asleep when you're around them. I was visiting the home of a very successful woman a couple years ago. On the surface, she had everything. A magnificent home, an incredible global business, all kinds of outside help. I was excited to meet her. While I was sitting at lunch, looking out the window at her beautiful gardens, I was suddenly overcome with sleepiness, like that poppy scene in The Wizard of Oz. I had to fight to keep myself awake. When lunch was finished and we went into the living room to visit, all I wanted to do was lie down on the rug and sleep. I'm serious. It was that bad. I kept biting my lip and pushing my nails into my palm to try to stay awake. I even pulled up the woman's astrologic chart and did her tarot cards, anything to stay awake and keep the conversation going. Happily, I was with a friend who was having the same reaction. Though we had planned to spend the weekend, we realized that we had to get out of there. So we hatched a plan to gracefully excuse ourselves. I've had the same thing happen on several other occasions with individuals who, on the surface, were charming and accommodating. But below the surface, something else entirely was going on. That's because vampires can be chameleons in relationships, often knowing how to give you just enough attention or improvement in behavior to keep you hooked. They will tell you exactly what you want to hear to keep you sucked in, feeding their narcissistic supply. When you threaten to end the relationship, the vampire will often become extremely accommodating and commit to change. They might even be willing to go see a therapist, and you think, oh my God, he gets it. Things are going to be better. But that's not true. What actually happens is that the vampire may put in just enough effort to get you to stay, usually by charming you with his words and promises to change. But no substantive change ever comes, and if you stay, this can be disastrous for your health and your life. One of my patients put it this way after finally divorcing a vampire. I swear, if he had given me just a crumb of affection or attention, I would have stayed. Thank God he didn't, because if I had stayed, I know I would have died of breast cancer. I'm pretty sure I was headed in that direction. Chapter 4, The Health Risks of Unbalanced Relationships. Have you ever seen a couple that just didn't seem to make sense? A stunningly attractive man with an overweight, puffy, tired-looking woman? Or the other way around? I'm guessing you have. And you may have found yourself wondering, what does he see in her? Here's the thing. These are vampire relationships. The person who looks like a million bucks is a vampire. And the person who looks drained and sick is a highly sensitive person, and the vampire's narcissistic supply. She is the source of his life energy. It's literally like a transfusion is occurring in which the vampire is draining the empath. Individuals who can see and sense energy can even observe this as energy cords between two people. Once you begin to understand the dynamics of a vampire relationship, you'll begin to observe how the vampire, when he or she doesn't have a source of narcissistic supply, suddenly becomes like a black hole. They have nothing to offer. That life of the party person you always enjoyed being around is reduced to a boring, complaining individual with nothing to offer. One of my colleagues told me that she can always tell when her former vampire husband has a new girlfriend. He suddenly cleans up, works out, looks like he's glowingly healthy. But when he's without a source to plug into, he looks old and tired and is extremely boring to be around. This is also when he's apt to call her, just to get a little hit of her energy. She no longer takes the calls. The relationship of an energy vampire to their source of supply is akin to what happens in nature when a parasitic plant, such as mistletoe, overtakes an elm tree. Mistletoe grows within the vascular system of a tree and extracts nutrients and water from that tree for survival. This is obviously not good for the health of the tree. Now, depending on how much the mistletoe takes over, it may actually end up killing the tree. It is the same for those in relationship with a vampire. If an empath has a strong constitution, eats well, and takes care of him or herself in other ways, then she or he may well be able to withstand the energy drain imposed by the vampire for a while. But over time, it takes a toll. And that's when the effects of being with an energy vampire are not just emotional or about feeling drained. The disparity in appearances is the first step toward a whole array of physical ailments that are often just as painful and dangerous as the psychological ones. In my experience, I've seen that highly sensitive people who stay in vampire relationships eventually end up suffering from health issues like adrenal fatigue, chronic Lyme disease, thyroid disorders, an inability to lose weight, irritable bowel syndrome, diabetes, breast cancer, and so-called mystery illnesses and autoimmune disorders that don't respond well to conventional medical treatments. In fact, I'd say that in my decades of experience on the front lines of women's health, the root cause of an individual's health problems is very often that they are involved with a vampire, either at home or at work. And until that is addressed, no exercise, meditation, yoga, or nutritional program is going to permanently help them regain and maintain their health. That's because every time they put a deposit in their health bank account by going on a yoga retreat or a juice cleanse or getting a massage, the vampire in their lives just drains them as soon as they return home. One of my colleagues who has a PhD in nutrition is also a yoga teacher and has given workshops internationally on healthy lifestyles and diets, was married to a vampire for 20 years. And despite all her knowledge and healthy behavior, she still suffered from debilitating adrenal fatigue and weight gain, despite an enormous amount of regular exercise. She took many trips to exotic places for health retreats, and I always wondered why she traveled so much. Turns out it was the only way she knew to survive, because every time she returned home all glowing and healthy, the same old vampire tactics drained her within a few weeks and she was right back where she started. In a recent phone conversation, psychologist Sandra L. Brown reported that fully 75% of the women who come to her retreats to recover from narcissistic abuse suffer from autoimmune disorders and the kinds of things I have previously mentioned. The chemical cause of illness. So, let's look at how physical health issues come about in a vampire relationship. On a basic level, the stress of having to deal with constant disappointment, negativity, trying to fix someone, deception, and all the other things that go on with a vampire relationship can lead to physical symptoms because of the chronic, unrelenting release of stress hormones in the body. It is very well documented that people who are exposed to chronic social conflict experience dysregulation of the immune system, thereby increasing their susceptibility to all kinds of infectious diseases, including so-called autoimmune disorders. According to WebMD, 75 to 90% of all visits to primary care doctors are for stress-related complaints. I can certainly attest to the validity of this from my own years in practice. In their groundbreaking publication, Stress in America, Our Health at Risk, released in 2012, the American Psychological Association surveyed Americans in the East, Midwest, South, and West. And though there were differences in the stressors listed in every region, relationship and family stressors were the second most common stressors after money throughout the entire country. If you were to drill down on exactly what these relationship stressors were, I have no doubt that you'd find that an inordinate amount of the relationship stress results from trying to get a vampire to take responsibility for his or her actions or cleaning up after them. So what happens when someone is under unrelenting stress? The adrenals produce a stress hormone known as cortisol. Under normal circumstances, small amounts of cortisol suppress inflammation and provide you with the ability to get out of danger. However, when cortisol levels remain high, the body actually begins to produce inflammatory chemicals known as cytokines. And these are associated with a whole host of symptoms, including headaches, weight gain, digestive problems, joint pain, and swelling, fibromyalgia, arthritis, and eventually diabetes and heart disease. You see, chronic cellular inflammation is the root cause of almost all chronic degenerative disease, including cancer and diabetes. Right now, many people with so-called autoimmune disorders are being told that their real problem is a virus, like Epstein-Barr. And while there's a level of truth to this, it is an incomplete explanation. There are millions of viruses around us and in us all the time. In fact, they are innate and often helpful. They're part of what is known as our microbiome, the trillions of bacteria and viruses that live in and on us all the time, and which are responsible for keeping us balanced and well. The only time that a virus such as Epstein-Barr, of which there are hundreds of types, including all the herpes viruses, becomes a problem is when your immune system is off balance because of chronic stress and cortisol levels that are too high. This is when your body isn't able to keep them in check naturally. How often have you found yourself popping NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, on a regular basis to ease the pain resulting from chronic cellular inflammation? Got a headache? Pop an ibuprofen. You get the picture. The problem with masking the pain of cellular inflammation with drugs is that it never addresses the real problem. The vampire causing you to live with perpetual stress that not only increases cellular inflammation on its own, but also encourages you to indulge in behaviors and dietary choices that increase cellular inflammation in their own right. Chronically high cortisol levels also wreak havoc with hormone levels. Libido often goes away when someone is under stress. And libido, which we often think of as just sex drive, is actually a subcategory of something much broader, something known as qi in traditional Chinese medicine. Qi is a good measure of one's life force. When there's excess cortisol, estrogen gets metabolized into an additional stress hormone, especially during perimenopause. Excess cortisol also results in high insulin levels and swings in blood sugar. The end result of all that is an insatiable craving for sweets or alcohol, weight gain, and inability to get a good night's sleep. All of this tends to show up big time at midlife, a time when our souls cry out to be heard, and when we find ourselves far less able to tolerate, at least physically, the manipulation of a vampire. Cognitive dissonance and stress. Back in 1957, Leon Festinger published a book called A Theory of Cognitive Dissonance that put forth the theory that we humans seek consistency in our beliefs and attitudes in any situation where two cognitions are inconsistent. The theory also states that a powerful motive to maintain cognitive consistency can give rise to irrational and sometimes maladaptive behavior. We all hold many beliefs about the world and ourselves. When they clash, this results in tension that is known as cognitive dissonance. Over time, cognitive dissonance in and of itself produces chronically high cortisol levels in the body and subsequent chronic inflammation. Pfistinger's theory of cognitive dissonance arose out of a study of a cult whose members believed that the earth was going to be destroyed by a flood. He investigated what happened to the cult members when the flood didn't happen, particularly those who had given up their homes and jobs to work for the cult. He found that the fringe members were very likely to admit that they had made fools of themselves and just put it down to experience, whereas the hardcore committed members interpreted the lack of a flood as evidence that the righteousness of the faithful had prevented the disaster. Dissonance can be reduced in three ways. First, individuals can change one or more of their behaviors to lessen the dissonance. An example would be the cognitive dissonance of a smoker who continues to smoke, knowing that smoking can cause cancer. In the first way to eliminate the dissonance, you accept the facts and change your behavior accordingly. In this instance, you'd have to give up smoking. The second way to reduce the dissonance is to get some new information. A committed smoker might point to cases of individuals who have smoked all their lives and never had a problem. The dissonance would be reduced within the individual by the new belief that smoking doesn't cause problems in all cases. And then the third way to reduce the dissonance is to decrease the importance of one's beliefs. So in the case of smoking, the smoker could say, "Oh well, I really enjoy smoking, and I'm going to live for today and enjoy my cigarette." In this example, every time the smoker encountered someone with smoking-induced cancer, or even thought about it, they would experience the stress of cognitive dissonance, and they would have to fight for the justification they've chosen. The same situation applies to an individual with super traits who is in a relationship with a vampire. These people absolutely believe in their heart of hearts that people can change, that love can heal anything, and that they can figure out how to help their partner. They experience the stress of cognitive dissonance every time the vampire does something hurtful, especially after years of fixing. When faced with lies, manipulations, and aggression, the individual with super traits will experience stress and then fight for justification in staying in the relationship. You may recognize this in yourself. Your partner puts you down, and you find yourself hanging on to the one memory of the time he was nice to you at Christmas, or the time he complimented you and told you you looked good, or the fact that he's really good in bed. Indeed, Sandra Brown has found evidence of brain changes in those who have lived with cognitive dissonance for years. Women describe not only anxiety and depression, but also brain fog and the inability to make decisions or to trust themselves. These oh-so-effective women who excel in every other area of life develop executive function disorders and lose the ability to think straight. And it isn't just Sandra who has seen this evidence. Recent studies reported in the neuroscientific literature using brain scanning technology have shown how people who have lived with cognitive dissonance have brain changes similar to people who've been diagnosed with PTSD. That's some pretty compelling evidence that shows just how life-changing this kind of emotional abuse can be. It also helps explain why so many of the women in Sandra Brown's retreats suffer from autoimmune disorders. In a 2017 article published in Arthritis and Rheumatology, researchers found that PTSD and more general trauma were associated with a higher risk of developing the autoimmune disease lupus. The risk was 3 times higher for women with PTSD and twice as high for women who had experienced trauma. This is just one of the numerous studies that has looked at the effect of psychological stress on the development of an autoimmune disease. In 2008, Autoimmunity Reviews published an article called "Stress as a Trigger of Autoimmune Disease" that noted, "Recent reviews discuss the possible role of psychological stress and of the major stress-related hormones in the pathogenesis of autoimmune disease. It is presumed that the stress-triggered neuroendocrine hormones lead to immune dysregulation, which ultimately results in autoimmune disease by altering or amplifying cytokine production. They concluded from these reviews that treatment of autoimmune disease should include stress management. Healthcare today. Back when I first started my medical practice in the 1980s, the term PMS was relatively new. None of my colleagues even believed that it existed. Noticing that PMS responded beautifully to lifestyle changes, I became fairly well known back then as a doctor who could help women who were experiencing monthly mood swings. Every single one of these women responded well to dietary change, B vitamins, exercise, and other stress reduction techniques for a while. And then, inevitably, almost none of them were able to sustain the lifestyle changes after 3 months. I wondered why. And over the years, I found that in nearly every case, the woman was either working with or living with a vampire. It was no wonder she couldn't sustain her healthy lifestyle. The root cause of her problem had never been diagnosed. It was the same with chronic pelvic pain. After all, it wasn't until the late 1980s that my profession even acknowledged the link between sexual abuse and pelvic pain. We doctors are trained to look for the physical cause. Back then, my colleagues would say to me, "We only see normal women," suggesting that the problems my patients were experiencing were all in their heads. That same cognitive dissonance runs throughout the healthcare system. The overarching belief that runs the system is this: germs, bad luck, or bad genes are the cause of illness. It has nothing to do with your diet, your relationships, or your life. But don't worry, there is, or soon will be, a drug that you can take for your condition. The fact that adverse pharmaceutical drug reactions and medical mistakes are the third leading cause of preventable death in the United States isn't even addressed. We're just trained to wait for the next big pharmaceutical breakthrough. I've been a doctor long enough to see that so-called mystery illnesses, which weren't taken seriously by conventional medicine 2 decades ago, have now become real and finally taken seriously only because a company has developed a drug to treat the symptoms. Fibromyalgia is a perfect example. 20 years ago, fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue were dismissed out of hand when women showed up suffering from this condition. Now, there's a drug that can be prescribed, but which doesn't even begin to treat the root cause of the problem. Fibromyalgia, like all illnesses to some extent, is a good example of how illness is actually a learned physiological response to specific stressors. As Dr. Mario Martinez points out, most illnesses involve a learned pattern, which at the beginning has a positive function. Let's take the inability to sleep soundly, which is so common in those suffering from chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. Lack of sound delta wave deep sleep results in widespread cellular inflammation, in part because deep sleep is absolutely essential for metabolizing stress hormones. Martinez suggests that being hypervigilant and learning to be a light sleeper may well be a highly adaptive strategy when you are living with a threat of some kind, like sexual or physical abuse. Later in adulthood, when that childhood threat is no longer relevant, the body's stress response and the impact on the psycho-neuro-immunologic system are still there. And over the years, this sets the stage for fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. Instead of looking at the root cause of a dysfunctional immune and nervous system, however, modern medicine always manages to find yet another drug and then prescribes it off-label, meaning that it can be given for purposes other than originally intended, at least until the drug company finds a study that suggests that the drug works for fill-in-the-blank. This is how Prozac and the other SSRIs have become popular as treatment for PMS and menopausal symptoms. All this, despite their addictive nature and the fact that they don't actually resolve the issue at its root cause, which is the hormonal effects of stress on the immune, nervous, and endocrine systems. Many people know in their guts that the majority of chronic health problems are the end result of emotional and psychological stress in their lives. It's very easy and culturally encouraged to ignore this information, given that the healthcare system largely dismisses the unity of the mind and body. Genetic determinism. One of the biggest pieces of misinformation in healthcare today is the notion that an individual's health is determined by his or her genes, and that no matter what we do, we're victims of our genes. Diseases run in your family. There's nothing you can do about it. These are the cards you've been dealt. But this isn't necessarily true. Dr. Bruce Lipton, developmental biologist and author of The Biology of Belief, points out that only about 10% of what happens to your body and your health is in any way related to your genes or your family history. That means that 90% of what happens to you, including how your genes get expressed, is determined by your environment. This is the science of epigenetics. And the important part of that environment is created by your beliefs, most of which you are not consciously aware of. Dr. Mario Martinez, founder of the Biocognitive Science Institute and author of The Mind-Body Code, points out that many Tibetan monks have diabetes that cannot be explained by their diet or lifestyle. In general, these monks eat healthfully. Yes, some are obese, and yes, many eat carbs, but they don't overeat or overload on sugar, and yet they still have an unusually high rate of diabetes. The work of Dr. Martinez and others suggests that the development of diabetes is intimately connected with their belief systems of forgiveness and loving kindness. More on this in a moment. According to biocognitive theory, what we believe and what our culture teaches us has more impact on our health than our diet and lifestyle factors. A great example of this is the research of Dr. Becca Levy of the Yale School of Public Health, who studied 660 people over the age of 50 in an Ohio community and found that those who had positive perceptions of getting older, which were already in place in their teenage years, conferred 7 extra years to their lives. That's right. Just the belief that growing older had positive aspects resulted in a longer life. And that was true even for those who smoked, were lonely, were obese, had high blood pressure, and never exercised. In other words, belief trumped all other measures we associate with longevity. Dr. George Solomon, a pioneer researcher in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, taught that the immune system has morals. It responds in a positive way to righteous anger, the kind of anger that is natural to feel when your own innocence or that of another is threatened. Our immune systems won't let us get away with bypassing our more difficult emotions if we want to remain healthy. Anger is, after all, the appropriate response when you are being abused. Suppressing it is a health risk. Let's go back to the Tibetan monks, who you might say are role models for what we empaths think we should be. The Chinese have done a huge amount of damage to the Tibetan culture and its people. They have raped, pillaged, and destroyed temples. The natural response to this is anger and rage. But the monks have been taught not to feel that anger and instead to send love to their enemies. This sends a signal to the body. I don't want to feel anger. I'm beyond my anger. The other factor with the Tibetan monks comes from their culture. The pioneering work of Dr. Daniel Goleman, author of Destructive Emotions, notes that the Tibetans don't have a word for emotion. In their world, thoughts and emotions are the same thing. So you could say that culturally, they are not well versed in the language of emotions and how they feel in the body. The monks learn to send empathic joy to those they should first feel angry with if they want to remain healthy. They literally sugarcoat their anger, and diabetes is the result. Dr. Martinez, who has worked with many Tibetan monks, said that they are trained not to care about their physical bodies either, and are focused only on spiritual matters like returning to Buddhahood where a body isn't necessary. So how does sending loving kindness to those who have harmed you without first feeling your anger result in stress that can lead to illness? When you do this, you experience the following biochemical cascade. The physical body confirms the desire to send only loving thoughts by producing large amounts of a chemical known as endorphin, akin to morphine. It numbs pain and prevents you from feeling things you don't want to feel. The problem is that chronically high amounts of endorphin adversely affect glucose metabolism over time, and type 2 diabetes is the result. I've known several highly sensitive people who attract energy vampires like a magnet, who have high blood sugar despite an almost perfect diet. And in all cases, these individuals sugarcoat everything they say and do. They appear to be literally unable to feel their anger. They instead go right to forgiveness and compassion. Tendency to gain weight. One of the most striking things I've observed in relationships between vampires and sensitive souls is the disparity in their tendencies to gain weight. Vampires are often, not always, far more able to maintain a healthy and attractive weight, and it often seems effortless. One vampire, when I bemoaned my inability to lose weight, once said to me, "I just stopped eating dessert for a couple of weeks and lost 10 pounds." I know what he was thinking. "I see the problem. You just lack discipline." But nothing could be further from the truth, especially for old soul empaths. We often have discipline to burn, and still, until we learn how to stop taking on the energy of others and draining our own, we're apt to do two things. One, be attracted to sugar, carbs, and or alcohol, and two, keep weight on no matter what we do, even if we stop eating carbs. Empaths tend to put on weight easily, in part because the weight acts as protection. Hence, the weight distribution in empaths is almost always in the middle of the body, that dreaded apple shape with excess belly fat that is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and diabetes. This weight distribution acts to protect the solar plexus, the area in the body associated with self-esteem and personal power. Until you learn how to create healthy boundaries and shore up your self-esteem, you're not likely to achieve a healthy weight. The power of our thoughts and beliefs. So when we look at the health of a person who is active as the source for a vampire, we have to look at the beliefs that they hold about themselves and their relationships. As discussed before, these beliefs, which are reinforced in a vampire relationship, start to be formed in childhood, when we are shamed and betrayed, forced into hiding who we truly are. And remember, toxic shame produces an inflammatory chemical known as IL-6, one of the cytokines. The link between adverse childhood experiences and illness is a growing field, with more and more studies being done each year. In one of the largest studies, the famous Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, acestudy.org, which started at Kaiser Permanente in the weight loss clinic, it was discovered that there's a direct relationship between the number of adverse childhood experiences, such as divorce of parents, a mentally ill parent, a chronically ill parent, or an abusive parent or relative, and the number of times the individual used the emergency room, filled prescriptions, or even died prematurely. Among people who've been exposed to major psychological stressors in early life, there is increased vulnerability to vascular disease, autoimmune disease, and premature death. And these tendencies show up as a person gets older. Remember that empaths are highly sensitive by nature, and so it may not take a truly major psychological stress to create future vulnerability. Researchers suggest that childhood stress somehow gets programmed into an immune system cell known as a macrophage through epigenetic markings. Epigenetic, meaning the way the environment affects the way a gene is expressed. Cells then become endowed with pro-inflammatory tendencies, which manifest as exaggerated cytokine responses to challenges and decreased sensitivity to inhibitory hormonal signals. The study abstract which was published in Psychological Bulletin in 2011, states, "The model goes on to propose that over the life course, these pro-inflammatory tendencies are exacerbated by behavioral proclivities and hormonal dysregulation, themselves brought about through exposure to childhood adversity." In real life, what that means is that childhood stress in susceptible individuals may give rise to excessive threat vigilance, always feeling like the worst is going to happen or that you're not worthy and thus vibrationally attracting it. Mistrust of others, poor social relationships, impaired self-regulation, and unhealthy lifestyle choices. Hormonally, early stress can also result in altered patterns of hormonal and nervous system regulation. So, in essence, adverse childhood events favor a pro-inflammatory environment both inside and outside the body. And this drives the body toward pathology unless the pattern is changed. It's fascinating that in Sandra L. Brown's experience working with survivors of vampire relationships, fully 75% of the women come from normal homes with no evidence of neglect or abuse. But I am willing to bet that if you dig a little deeper, you'll find that these super trait women have some dings in their self-esteem resulting from either a past life or their childhood. There is evidence to suggest that one of the true risk factors for autoimmune disorders, for example, what is called autoimmunity, is the childhood experience of having our survival linked to conforming to expectations that are actually a violation of who we really are. Dr. Gabor Mate, a physician and expert in stress and childhood development, says that every single one of his patients has struggled with emotional repression as a coping style. Moreover, not one has ever been able to answer yes to the following question: when, as a child, you felt sad, upset, or angry, was there anyone you could talk to, even when he or she was the one who had triggered your negative emotions? In his magnum opus, When the Body Says No, Mate cites study after study demonstrating the effect of particular stressors on the physical body that directly and powerfully express how immunity behaves. For example, a study of African American versus Nigerian men showed that though both groups have the same number of potentially malignant cells in their prostate glands, fully 6 times as many African American men actually develop prostate cancer. Same genes, completely different environment. Researchers, including Mate and Dr. Lawrence Lashan, make the argument that those of us who twist ourselves into pretzels to please others, or who otherwise suppress our own emotional needs in service to others, are at particular risk for developing immune system problems such as Hashimoto's thyroiditis, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and so on. The reason for this is that the immune system confirms what we already believe. As I already suggested before, if you believe that you are worthy and lovable, your immune system will confirm that. If, on the other hand, you are depressed and feel worthless, you will be far more susceptible to everything, including the common cold. A fascinating study from the University of Pittsburgh, in which volunteers had their throats sprayed with cold viruses, found that those who were the most likely to actually get sick were the ones with the weakest social networks and support systems. On the other hand, those who had 4 or more different social groups with whom they interacted regularly were far less likely to get sick, despite everyone being exposed equally. The work of Dr. Bruce Lipton, author of The Biology of Belief, points out that it is the membrane of the cell that is, in fact, the brain of the cell. And cell membranes are connected with each other so intimately that a single thought courses through the body with lightning speed, creating biochemical changes in our cells that are the result of the quality of our thoughts. When we believe that we aren't worthy or valuable, our lives are saturated with a particular type of chronic self-denial. We too often end up controlled by energy vampires who relegate us to a subordinate position. This can leave us feeling disempowered and helpless, and sooner or later, we get sick. Countless studies have confirmed the unity of body and mind, despite the fact that conventional medicine is still based on an artificial split between the mind and body. The conventional medical drugs and surgery approach, though amazingly wonderful when dealing with trauma, leads people to believe that their state of health is determined by bad luck, bad genes, or a deficiency of some drug. But in truth, your state of health is very intimately connected with your core beliefs, and the quality of your day-to-day emotions stems directly from those thoughts. As I've already stated, about 90% of our beliefs aren't even conscious, and the vast majority of them are negative. But our conscious mind is the place where our hopes and dreams reside. So our job, as empaths who want to make the biggest healing impact we can and live our best possible lives, is to be willing to do the work necessary to upgrade our beliefs and thoughts and feel and release any emotions that haven't been fully felt and named. Part 2, Healing from Darkness. Chapter 5, Recognizing Your Vampire. So now that you understand the vampire-empath relationship and the terrible results you can experience as a side effect, let's get into the good part, how to fix it. The first step in this is learning how to recognize a vampire. This will help you see the people in your life for who they are, and it will also help you spot a vampire before you get in relationship with them next time. So let's delve a bit more deeply into their personal characteristics. What makes someone a vampire, and how to see their manipulation tactics before you become entangled? Diagnosing your vampire. It is only in the past 25 years or so that energy vampires have been clearly identified by the mental health profession. That is why so many of them have so successfully continued to manipulate their families and society in general. Make no mistake, energy vampires are often charming and charismatic. You often can't take your eyes off them until you realize who they really are. They know exactly what to say to whom and when to say it. And they are masters at getting others to do their bidding. My friend Bob Palumbo, a PhD psychologist with 35 years of experience, says that some are so very charming that even he, with all of his experience and knowledge, can be taken in. It's important for all of us to know this. Labels for the behavioral patterns of vampires include sociopaths, psychopaths, narcissists, borderline personalities, or people who are prone to antisocial behavior. But all of these personality types can be grouped under the term Cluster B. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5, a publication of the American Psychiatric Association, notes that Cluster B individuals are characterized by dramatic, overly emotional, or unpredictable thinking or behavior. This designation includes antisocial behavior, sociopathy, borderline personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, and NPD, narcissistic personality disorder. The antisocial ones are liars and cheats and have recurring problems with the law. They disregard their own safety or the safety of others. They often engage in repeated violation of the rights of others. They won't take responsibility for their actions and are often aggressive, impulsive, and even violent. Those with borderline personality disorder engage in impulsive and risky behavior such as unsafe sex, gambling, or binge drinking or eating, but can also be unbelievably compelling and charming. They often threaten self-injury or say they are going to commit suicide, especially if you don't give them what they want. Far more women than men are considered borderlines. They operate with what is called intermittent reinforcement, the most difficult kind to deal with. Sometimes they're there for you, sometimes they are not. This inconsistency is maddening and makes you feel crazy. The good men who have been in relationship with borderline women often end up like empty husks by the side of the road, having had a borderline suck their lifeblood from them. One of my colleagues recently told me that when she was growing up, her mother often threatened